Hey y'all, it's Delaney.
And it's Katie, and this is Classically Black Podcast,
where we talk all things classical music and being black in the profession.
With trap beats playing in the background. Hey.
Hey y'all. Happy Women's History Month.
We Rosie the Riveter right now.
Okay.
There's like so much women's history in between that, but you know, we move.
Well,
Coretta. Be right. Someone's Coretta this month.
Okay. And see. So now it's over. But we'll probably put together, I think we've done this for other months, but we'll put together a little episodes to listen to this month if you're not a day one classically blacker. That's what we call our fandom.
No, we do not. The blacks.
Oh my gosh. Some people just be trying too hard with the fandom names. I'm like, not everybody needs to have one.
I don't think we qualify. Either way, it's going to be offensive.
Like, we just, if you would be one, thank you. But we don't qualify.
Like, the listeners is fine.
When Ice Spice was talking about the spice cabinet, I'm like, girl, hang it up.
I don't think she came up with that on her own. You probably saw it in a comment somewhere.
And hang it up to whoever said it. But she latched onto it. What's her name? It's cute. I think Koi calls her people the Koi Pond. Which is cute.
That's cute.
But it's hard to also say that. Like, so what do you call them? Like,
ponders.
Yeah, I guess.
Fish. Okay. Droplets. What else be in a pond? Leaves.
Oh, what else be in there? The algaes.
I'm about to say algae. Oh my god. If y'all have a name to actually, no, never mind. Never mind. Please. We're so far into this. I wouldn't even remember to call y'all that.
At all. So. Well, anyway, the news this week. The American Federation of Musicians has announced that they've reached a tentative agreement with the Alliance of Motion Pictures and Television Producers on two of their contracts, the Basic Theatrical Motion Picture and Basic Television Motion Picture contracts. We talked a little bit about unions with Jen a couple months ago. And, of course, the strikes was going on between SAG-AFTRA and who was it? Oh, WGA, duh. And AMPTP. So the musicians have also been in the middle of their own back and forth with them, but they reached a tentative agreement. Apparently the chief negotiator for AFM International, and who's also the president, said we've secured a historic breakthrough in streaming residuals, established critical guardrails against the misuse of AI, gained meaningful wage increases, and made other important improvements. This agreement represents a watershed moment for artists who create the soundtracks for countless film and TV productions. Which I was like, period, because you know they was about to be in there with the MIDI orchestra.
Listen.
Which is crazy. Apparently, full details of the contract will remain confidential until it's completely approved. For ratification, and so voting members of AFM will be voting on it momentarily, and period. Good for them. Because I didn't actually hear very much about this, to be honest,
before I saw it. I know what you're talking about. I didn't know that was negotiated.
I know
a lot of girls have been doing that because Second City, they was like, oh, are we about to strike? And then the American Ballet Theater, they was like, oof, are we about to strike? So, like, I wonder what's going on. Maybe it's just time for, maybe they all fell in the same year or a couple of years.
Yeah, this inflation got people on it. On their booties. Like, it's bad out here. Okay, and then secondly, I was going to only do two pieces of news this week. I have a little recap of a rabbit hole that went on this past week that if you follow me on Twitter, you probably saw. So I don't know if you saw this because I feel like you wasn't really around. I saw a couple tweets from you, but you wasn't really around in my little hyperfixation. So did you see that thing, that Bon Appetit article that was going around? Mm-hmm. You didn't see that? Okay.
What was it about?
So there was this Bon Appetit article. Bon Appetit, the food publication, does this thing called The Receipt where they like, it's kind of like a money diary, how Refinery 29 does that, but for food. So they post this thing saying there's a person who has a yearly income of $950,000. They're 45.
Listening.
Right. They're 45 years old. Their family size, these are all the categories they do for the receipt. The family size is 1 on weekdays, 2 on the, or 3 on the weekends, because they have the kids on the weekends. Their location, San Francisco. How much they spent on food in 1 week, $3,506.41. Wow. Their occupation, orchestra conductor. So I was like,
I bet you. So let's find out who it is.
Oh, that's why I'm like, you wasn't there. I was like, I bet you I could find out who this is. I went down this crazy rabbit hole. I'm going to walk y'all through it because it was crazy. Y'all wasn't there.
I'm set.
I'm going to put the link to my thread. I put a whole thread together. I'll put the link in the description if you want to follow along, if you want to whatever. Oh, there's also other parts of it. Their most expensive purchase of the week was a tasting menu with sake pairings at a restaurant called Nisei, which was $1,216.39. Their least expensive purchase was a tea for $3.70. So what we know about them from that, orchestra conductor, 950K, whatever. I was like, I bet y'all can find out who it is. So the first thing I did was I checked all the usual suspects. Of course, they're in San Francisco. Of course, San Francisco Symphony, I checked. Esa-Pekka Salonen, music director there, is too old. He's 65. This person's 45. Can't be him. SF Opera, Unsung Kim, who's their conductor, is a woman. And I saw from the article that this is a man. Can't be her. It's not the dude from SF Ballet. He's too old. None of the conductors who, I was thinking maybe a guest conductor at SFCM, maybe somebody who has ties to San Francisco, whatever. It was none of those people. And I was like, that makes it kind of harder because $950,000 is not unheard of for an orchestra conductor. But if you don't have like, oh, and also that was another thing that ruled out Esa-Pekka Salonen. He makes much more than $950,000, probably at least twice that. But the people that's making 950K, like that's up there in terms of orchestra conductors, you know?
Yeah.
So, okay, I need to go through the thread. I was like, so I had a couple of suspects. But I knew this person had to have ties to San Francisco, even though they said they travel a lot. So I'm like, so they're a freelance conductor, but they have to have ties to San Francisco because first of all, why would you live in San Francisco?
Yeah, if you could live, I mean, besides your kids being there.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, maybe it's the kids. Because San Francisco is expensive, but also if you make $950,000, then, like, I guess. So one of the things, so they said they had two sons, ages 10 and 8. And then another thing that stuck out from the article, they had three mortgages. I was like, okay, noted. And also, one of the questions that they asked is, how often did your parents and guardians cook at home? And they mentioned at separate parts in the article, two Chinese dishes that I was like, okay, other people can cook Chinese food, but the way that they said it, they said whenever they would ask their parents how to make something, how to cook this Chinese braised pork shank, which is called tipang or tipong probably, they would just say, well, it depends on the meat and the size of the container and it changes each time. And like he said that it took him years to figure out how it is. I was like, that gives like y'all are Chinese, because why would somebody say that about something they got out of a cookbook? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, or that, like freaking fried rice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or like dumplings even.
Yeah, it gives like when your parents don't have a recipe, they just make it. They just know how to mm-hmm. make it. So mm-hmm. I was like, okay, noted. I had one false start, one false person. I thought it was they were half Chinese. Ended up not being him because he matched the age range within a year. But it doesn't seem like he lived in San Francisco, and I couldn't find out if he had any kids. It wasn't him. I also found there was an article from SF Chronicle who they had written about this whole thing, trying to figure out who it was. And they had interviewed multiple conductors in San Francisco.
People so nosy.
Because everybody's like, this sounds like the headline was SF conductor with $950,000 salary splurges on fine dining. Something is fishy. Because they was like,
yeah, but also, I'm not trying to be rude, but like $900,000, you have three properties? I don't know.
What do you mean?
That don't sound like a lot of money to have three properties.
Well, they didn't say what they were all in San Francisco.
That is true.
And also, have three mortgages, but you don't know if there's income on those properties.
Or like...
two.
Yeah, okay.
And that was something I considered as well. Like, does this person have... is all that $950,000 from conducting? Probably not. Okay. So another thing was that, yeah, the three mortgages, I was like, perhaps they don't live in San Francisco for full time. And I also wondered if anybody who was in the article was being messy and it was actually them and they wasn't saying nothing. Because one of the things that I did after I checked all the usual suspects, I started checking like assistant conductors and people like that. And then they talked about having to travel a lot, and then they talked about other parts in the Bay Area. And so then after I was like, I'm not getting anywhere in San Francisco, I expanded my search to just Bay Area orchestras, because you could be, you know, around. And he mentioned some other places, and I found somebody that I was like, oh, this seems like it's him. Okay, so this is when I've like figured it out and I did a whole thing. I said, after several suspects and no luck looking in San Francisco, I expanded my search to include other Bay Area orchestras. I looked in Oakland. Nobody matched it there. Then I checked Berklee Symphony. And I was like, I knew that, of course, I was looking for somebody that was possibly Chinese or Chinese American. And there was this dude's name was Ming Luke. And I was like, okay, Ming, let's look into you. He is principal guest conductor at SF Ballet. Which, when I looked at SF Ballet, they didn't have him on. It was hard because it's a ballet, and so the information on the conductors and stuff was not very prevalent. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, that ties him to San Francisco. And somebody pointed out there's a coffee shop that he would go to in the article, because it's like every day he says what he eats. A coffee shop that he would go to that was like on the same street as the concert hall.
You're wasting a career in music. You need to be investigating.
No, okay, to be fair, somebody pointed that out and tagged me once they saw I was looking into it. Because I wouldn't even have thought to be on Google Maps. Like, okay, so.
I was like, girl.
that was like, okay, dang. But I still use it to my advantage. There was a coffee shop, and all the places are together. The opera, the symphony, and the ballet, they're all like near each other. It's a coffee shop he went to multiple times throughout the week. So he's at the ballet, check. Also saw that he's principal conductor of the Nashville Ballet. And I was like, okay, well, you hold a position there. It would make sense for you to have somewhere. You might have a mortgage in Nashville. That would explain at least one other mortgage. I was like, okay, period. And then his age checked out. I found an article from 2019, said he was 40, makes him 45 now. And then when I checked his Instagram, I saw he had so many pictures of food. I was like, oh, so he's a foodie.
Let me look him up. Ming Luke.
He's a foodie. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I have my smoking gun. In the Bon Appetit article, he says, a long time ago, I was on a quest to visit every single Michelin star restaurant in Northern California. I saw on his Facebook, he says, I just celebrated visiting every single Michelin star restaurant in Northern California. That's what Mean Luke said on Facebook in November. I was like, okay, that's too, Like, that's too specific. Like, it has to be him. I was like, I found him. I was like, man, can I hold a dollar? But then somebody
This is so messy.
Somebody came questioning my findings. And so I was like, So I was talking to Sam about it. And he, of course, like, Sam, he'd been, you know, around longer. He kind of knows more about the industry. And he was like, I just don't believe that he's making $950,000. I'm like, that was the hardest thing to find. And I never confirmed anything about his kids. I just couldn't find, you know, he probably just keeps his kids offline, which, period.
Right.
So I decided to, like, reopen the investigation because, because Sam was like, I think it's James Gaffigan. He told me to ask Jen, actually, because they're friends. But I was like, I feel like that's cheating. I'm just going to, I'm not going to ask Jen. It's him. So when I was talking about him, he was like, yeah, I don't think it's him. I think it might be James Gaffigan because there are some things that line up. He's the same age. He gets more high profile engagements. So $950,000 seems more plausible for him.
Oh, and he kind of.
But I couldn't find, he at least used to live in San Francisco, but I couldn't find anything that seemed like he lived there recently. But he might because of his family. Maybe his family still lives there, but he also has a lot of engagements abroad and just around. So three mortgages could possibly be that. But I saw that, so the person in the Bon Appetit article has an ex-wife and two sons. Gaffigan does have two sons and an ex-wife. He actually has two ex-wives, which I was.
Oh, never mind.
But that's important. That is important.
Looking like, hold on, let me find out Gaffigan, please. What's going on over there? Two?
But I saw an article in 2014 that mentioned that he had a daughter who at the time was two, and then he was also expecting, which that son at that time would be 10 now, so that would be the 10-year-old son. I was like, okay. But no, there was no mention of the daughter. So why you have your two sons on the weekends, but not the daughter? And it was, he had the daughter and the son with his first wife, and then the second son with the second wife. But what made me think it was not him, among other things, was that daughter, not mentioning the daughter, but the fact that in the article on Bon Appetit, it made it seem like the two sons were by the same mother. Because he was like, oh, their mother came to pick them up. I was like, that could just be just him simplifying it, because that doesn't have anything to do with what it is. Like, you don't have to be like, well, my first marriage and then I had.
Like, what if he just doesn't see the daughter on the, and it's like not a profile on him? Like,
yeah.
You don't see the daughter like during the summers. That doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. But it was the fact that he said their mother comes and picks them up. Like, he said their mother and I divorced. And so I have them, like, whatever. I was like, that implies they have the same mother, but also it could just be he not telling his business like that. Mm-hmm. Then there was the thing about ethnicity. I thought that this person was probably going to be Chinese. Sam was like, well, you know, that could just be, like, him throwing off the scent a little bit, like, and other people.
Oh, right, because, like, why would you want people to know who you are? Okay.
And then, I was like, well, I mean, yeah, white families can cook Chinese, but that whole thing about the way the parents wouldn't give him, like, a recipe or, like, didn't have a recipe for it made it seem like that's, like, a family recipe or something like that. Like, the way that they said, like, oh, well, it depends. Oh, we don't really have a recipe for it. Like, to me, that doesn't give, like, we're white and we just like cooking Chinese food. That gives, like, this is authentic to our culture. He was like, I don't know. Then there was something else in the article. He did, this person played 94 concerts this year. Sam was like, there's no way Ming is playing on 94 concerts. And I was like, well, the article says he has 94 performances this year, not engagements. And I'm like, that could just be, for the sake of the article, him saying how many concerts he's playing. Which to me is weird, but I think it could be just because people don't understand, like, if you're not in classical music, you don't understand that the same program can be played, like, three or four nights in a row or something, and that's your engagement. Because to say that you make $950,000 a year and you say, like, oh, I had 27 engagements this year, but people don't know that some of those engagements are festivals where you're playing, like, multiple concerts. I was like, he probably counted each concert out because people don't, so that it would make it, I guess, make sense to people who are not in classical music, the mm-hmm. fact that you're playing so much and it adds up to this amount of money. Because I looked on Ming's website and he had 27 engagements, but each of those engagements had multiple dates on it. So if he had said, oh, well, I have 27 engagements, people are going to be like, dang, orchestra conductors, they only got to play 27. They got 27 days of work in a year and they're making $950,000. Yeah. Like, that just wouldn't, it just wouldn't make any sense. So when I counted out all the stuff, that was kind of like a middle of the road thing. Like, it would be plausible for him to have 94 engagements if you counted it that way. But anyway,
I'm not sold on him only because of, like, not to be, you know, reductive, but like Berklee Symphony and assistant conductor somewhere else, like,
that don't add up about the money. And of course, on his website, he has other like stuff. Those are his posts. And then of course, like, he's playing other stuff, but still he wasn't getting the amount of like engagements that I felt like would add up to $950,000, which is why I'm thinking like all that money is not coming from orchestra conducting.
That's or like he get in some type of trust, not trust, but like,
exactly,
comes from a rich family. You got 3 properties.
Exactly. You could be making income on all of those, especially in San Francisco.
Yeah. Especially like if he's traveling back and forth. I lost track. Who's the one going back and forth to Nashville? He is? Ming Luke?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so who's in that house in Nashville? Yeah. Why are you not there? If it's an Airbnb. But even then, that still don't add up.
Yeah.
He has to come from a rich family.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I could think of.
Somebody was like, if you have, depending on what you have, like in San Francisco, you could bring in like $200,000-$300,000 a year off of rental property.
Oh,
like, depending on what you had, you got a duplex, a fourplex, something like that.
Mm.
And it, like, you could. But I was like, But then my last piece of evidence fell into place. So, of course, the whole thing about the Michelin star restaurants was like, to me, that was nailing the coffin before, because you explicitly said Michelin starred in Northern California. Like, that's just mm-hmm. super specific. Mm-hmm. And again, Sam was like, well, you know, that could be him trying to throw, that could be James Gaffigan trying to throw people off. But I'm like, why would you try to throw people off by saying something that explicitly points to someone else? I could see like, oh, something yeah. that points against you, but why he, and so now he on Ming Luke's Facebook going, oh, Ming said this, I'm gonna make it right now. Like, I was just like, So in the article, the person, they said that they follow a bunch of like food accounts and stuff like that. Ming follows a bunch of food accounts, including some of the specific ones that are mentioned in the article. I was like, period. James doesn't. That could be, he could have another account, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. We'll see. Then I was like, well, maybe I could find a connection between one of the places that the person went to go eat and somewhere that Ming has been, because he posts his food. Mm-hmm. At first, I didn't find anything. And I was like, well, that makes sense, because you don't want to post like all the stuff that's going to be published in this article, because then it would be very easy for people to place you. But then in the article, he said he made a last minute reservation at Nisei, which was the most expensive thing. And he said, which I haven't been to since its opening. Sounds like, okay, I'm going to go a little further back on his Instagram. Why I find a post from him at Nisei 3 weeks after it opened, eating the same thing? I was like, eh. It's him. Then I did a poll. I think people think it's him, and that the income, there's something else going on there. And because it's a more of a food diary than like a money diary, I could see them not going in depth about like, where does all your money come from,
mm-hmm.
and just what's your profession. Because if it was a money diary, like how Refinery 29 does it, then they would have him post like every single thing that he does to make money.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yeah, I was in my detective bag. I was, you know, cracking the code. Yeah, we got it. So, bottom line, donations at classicallyblackpodcast.com, Ming.
I wonder why anyone would do that. I don't know. It depends. Maybe it's like fun, I guess. I don't know.
With the diary. Especially if you,
I feel like where I see myself going career wise, it will be fun because literally you wouldn't be able to guess. I mean, maybe there would be some specific indicators because of like, of all the things I want to do, the combination would be like, hold on, this, but also, yeah, I feel like it would be hard to like figure out, but I just don't see myself being like, okay, so I spend this much for food and this is what I spend every week. Like, that's kind of a lot to me.
Do you read Money Diaries? No. Oh, you know, I went through a little thing where I was reading them. But I found it, I think he probably, I don't know what he thought was finna happen, but from a classical music perspective, like, it was just, that's just so specific that it's like, when I saw that, I was like, I know I can figure it out because it can't be that many people. It just can't be with those details.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, I feel like. Yeah. He said what? He said he was a conductor. He said he was a classical musician.
He said orchestra conductor.
I would have been like classical musician. Because then that could be anybody.
That would be good.
Yeah, I would have said classical musician. And also, that's great deceptive promotion for classical music. More people will join. Because when I told, I already told the story, but when I told Masur what principal oboes make in orchestra, she was like, where is the oboe store at? She was like, nah, my son playing oboe. Like, false advertising. But that's, I mean, what your son should play oboe.
That'd be, we're fun. In the That'd comments like, oh, dang, well, I should have been a conductor. I could have been. I'm like, okay, girl.
Good luck. Godspeed.
But I wonder if people probably would have narrowed it down, though, if he said classical musician because of how much traveling he was doing. They probably was like,
Yeah, maybe. But you could be a soloist. You could be a concertmaster. Oh, yeah. You could be.
Soloist would probably be what people would think because that would be very possible.
Yeah, even more than that, they're probably way more than that.
Yeah,
you could be an influencer. Them Vegemite dudes down there, like, they probably make something around that, if not more.
I feel like I feel like they're probably one of the only ones, though. To be fair, the whole San Francisco, like, the where you're at.
Oh, but they live in, yeah.
Yeah, they live in Australia. And that would have carried away immediately.
Especially the types they make way more than 900,000. I would assume.
Mm-hmm. I also wonder how much it costs to run that business. They have employees, too. They be out here, though. Anyway. Yep. That was my hyperfixation while my projects collected dust. So,
girl, I'm on this board that I really have no business being on, and I'm also a committee chair, and there's nothing to report, girl. I gotta figure out how I'm gonna weasel my way out of that for tomorrow. So, we move anyway. So, I was on TikTok per usual. That was a useless sentence, and I found out that the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, School of Medicine, they got a $1 billion donation from a billionaire widow. And so, you know, now their school is tuition free. And there's been a lot of discussion on it, namely, well, now that their school is tuition free, it's going to be all these applicants and blah, blah, blah. So this doctor jumped in on the conversation. She was like, well, actually, no. She said that NYU School of Music, NYU's medical school already is tuition free. And they had similar concerns. They're like, man, now we're going to have double the amount of applicants because it's free to come here. And what they found was the following year that they originally had 6,000 applicants. In the following year, they had 8,000 applicants. So not that much of an increase. But what they did find is that between, I'm going to pull it up the exact dates. Okay. between the years 2017 and 2018, the amount of disadvantaged students that were accepted into NYU went from 12% to 3%. So that's a huge drop, especially considering disadvantaged can mean a lot of things, but historically we're going to include POC in that number just because, yes, and I was right because I went to the next slide. So in 2017, 14% of the admitted students were Black, and then in the following year, oh, it doesn't say. I hate when graphs do this. This looks like around 7%, and then it went back up in 2019 to 11%. But they have been able to recover since, like, that 14%. So we were talking about, oh, she was saying that the reason why this is not really a huge help is that when schools go tuition free, especially incredibly competitive ones like medical school, there's a certain amount of seats that they're limited seats. Apparently it has something to do with the amount of residencies that are available. There's like a certain amount of doctors that can be prospective doctors that can be admitted into a school. And then also other like foolish things like too many unemployed doctors impacts the statistics of like the integrity of the school. I'm losing my words today, but like it just impacts like the notoriety of the school if too many of your graduating class is unemployed. So all of these things play together. Then so the number of admitted students did not change. However, now you have more applicants, so now it's more competitive, and you have more students who have more money and more access applying to making sure that they get in. So if you know that it's tuition free, and if you already have a lot of money, you can pay to take the MCAT more times, you can pay for tutors, you can pay for application reviews that your fellow colleagues who do not have access to those materials would not be able to do. So what the result was that more of the people in the medical school class were rich, which inadvertently made it more white. So this made me think about Peabody immediately, because we talked about Peabody either last week or the week before. But when I went back to be like, oh shoot, this is going to be interesting because I wonder how this is going to affect Peabody. Oh my God, is it going to be more white over there? Not necessarily, because Peabody is about need base. So they said, if you can pay $65,000 to come to our school, you'll be paying $65,000 American dollars to come to our school. However, they ain't doing loans no more. So I'm like, okay, so I'm curious to see how their stats will change, but probably not by much, because if the more rich people are not going to apply because they still got to pay to go. So, I mean, more people might apply, but it made me think about how, well, I want to get your thoughts on this, but it made me think about more how these little measures of like tuition free and whatever don't actually address the problem in classical music. And for years on this show, we've gone on and on and on about like change must happen at different facets. And we're seeing it. We're seeing like the beginning stages. I will call the beginning stages of change. We see Elsa STEM inspired programs making a headway here in the US. There's so many of them. We see fellowship programs. We see whatever. That's one of the ones I have on top of my head. I mean, tuition assistance would be helpful, but there's so many other things that like it can't be like a one type of band-aid thing that will fix all of the problems. Because even in this small example of doctors getting tuition free, it's like, oh great, now it's tuition free, maybe more Black people will apply and whatever, and like that's just simply not the case. So I wanted some of your initial thoughts on that, and then we could like talk about some other things.
I'm on my going blank as soon as you stop talking. That's crazy. One of the things that came to mind when we were talking about it before was like, I don't know what considerations go into someone going to medical school, but what I was curious about in terms of how this will affect Peabody's applications is like there's just a lot of considerations that go into like where you study music, you know, like your teacher and like just stuff like that. Like for me, it was like teacher and how often you play, not just how well you work with the teacher, but how invested they are with like the school community. There was people that like their teachers would be gone all the time and they would come up and do a bunch of lessons in a week, and I'm just like, that would make me not go somewhere. Like, and so there's just like, I'm more familiar with the aspects that go into the decision to go to a music school. So I wonder, like, I mean, I know that money is also, of course, a big factor in where you apply to go to school and all that type of thing. But I wonder where it would rank in terms of, like, now there are people considering going to Peabody that maybe weren't before, or just moved up in their hierarchy of schools, how this is going to affect all those other factors that people consider when they're choosing a school. And I don't know how that might have affected like the medical school students, because I just don't know what do y'all be considering.
I will say from my personal experience, when I had that bill staring down at me when I was wrapping up at Eastman, I was like, oh, that's crazy. I would just laugh at it. Every time I log into Sallie Mae, I'd be like, oh, that's crazy. I don't even know what she called now. Ambient, Advantage, whatever it is. I was like, oh, that's a very large number. So when I was looking at what I was finna do next, I was like, okay, so this gonna have to be almost free. And the only thing I would pay for is, I was looking at MSM, which is ironic because the teacher I was wanting to work with at MSM, it's no T, like it's literally on her, in her bio, but she teaches like on both coasts.
Oh, I remember.
So how the bumbleclot know? Like, how does that, so even if you can get to my lesson, you jet lagged. Right. And it's like, what's my experience gonna be with that? And like, it's like, well, she was like, well, baby girl, focus on these excerpts and don't worry about what your experience will be with, like, with me. But it's something that it's something that I ignored because I was like, well, if I got an MSM, I'm going to MSM, period. Like, they had this orchestra thing, which I wouldn't have applied for if I knew he was only picking one viola, like one violist. They picked one, which I know is like, yeah, Katie, whatever. No, isn't that, that's not insane to you?
No, that's crazy.
I thought that was insane. Like, they pick one violist. I would not have applied, especially like you have all these teachers here and it's one violist for this particular program, for their like orchestral certificate. Which maybe Eastman's the same, actually, now that I think about it.
No, Eastman, I want to check in on that Concertmaster program that Eastman doing. I guess it hasn't started yet. I'm curious about that.
Because how many they take? That's what I want to know, how many finna take. I guess we find out in 4 years how many that, maybe, I don't even know how you find that out. But like, I know Eastman, like, I don't know if it's one, but it's like only a couple, if two is probably generous, get that performer certificate jury thing. Like, only, they're not picking, it don't matter how good you play down, it's about how everybody play and they pick best. Yeah. Like, I would.
I forgot about PC jury.
I remember Miss Taylor, I was like, you know, I think I want to go for the PC jury. He was like, why don't you calm down?
Because honestly, like,
and I'm glad I did, because
honestly, like, isn't it just for decoration? Like,
it's for decoration. It's
a feat. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe other people have an equivalent, but like, you have your jury requirements, which is so crazy. Cause I just play for my jury when my teacher told me to play. But PC jury, like, if you decide you want to go for it, it's this whole crazy list of things that you have to do that it's like a super jury, and and you either get it or you don't when you decide to go for it. But like, I don't even, it's just for decoration.
You know what that feels like though, you music student, you want to do everything, like whatever sound good, like
I'm sure I considered that one point too, but there was no way I was gonna do that.
When I saw the violist that went for it, I think he got it. I'm pretty sure he got it. It's like, because any jury is going to be like a recital program. I mean, at the graduate level. When I was an undergrad, I played what I was working on. But I was going to a state school.
Still recital.
Yeah, like, I went to an, like, and I also had different goals. I was a music education major. I was playing at a different level. Like, she was mm-hmm. like, you gonna play what we working on, Buki. But yeah, Eastman, it was a, I only had to play one jury. Oh shoot, I can't remember. Oh, it didn't even matter. The jury was like a another thing to do, because it's like I already played my recital, so I had to turn around and play. You had to do a recital
your jury year? I mean,
oh wait, am I remembering it wrong? Your
recital year?
Am I remembering it wrong then?
Because usually you don't. Usually your jury is before that, and then your recital takes the place of it.
Okay, maybe I don't remember, because I was also there for 3. Oh my god, I can't believe my memory is slipping. Because I wonder if it was something weird like that, where I did do that. But there's no way, because my stuff was all kind of weird, because I was also music ed, so my classes were just not in the right order sometimes. I was kind of just vibing. Oh, maybe I'm thinking about that little, that made me kind of mad, because why you asking me all these questions?
Remember you played on my jury?
I did?
Yeah.
Then what did I play on my jury? I don't remember. That's crazy. I don't remember at all.
Dang.
Did I have a jury? Wait, that's crazy. Hold on. Let me go back.
I'm sure you did.
It's literally a graduation requirement. Why did I only have to play one? Oh, because you don't do a jury on your recital year.
Yeah.
Oh, that's how I was an undergrad too. That's I think that's a music wide.
Yeah. So you probably just had the one.
And I didn't play a jury every year. That's what. Because normally, as a master's student, I would have played a jury my first year, and I would have played my recital my second year. But I had 3 years. That's why I can't remember. Because I did not play a jury my first year. But what did I play for my jury? Anyway, I don't know. I could probably find it. Oh, you have to do a jury program. Oh, it's probably on this computer. Yeah. Wait, I have to know now.
Not her looking at the jury.
I have to know, because I literally, like, I feel like. Now my computer saying, girl, what?
Right, you trying to search.
You don't know that word. Jury program PDF. Jury.
Oh, I forgot I did. I forgot I did a
jury program. Okay.
I have all mine.
Bertha, don't start smoking now.
I forgot I did an internship at the jury commissioner's office, so that came up.
Okay, 2018. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. That's why I couldn't remember. Oh. I play all this?
Yeah. Eastman, girl.
I don't remember. The way I don't remember this at all, is that a trauma response? Oh, because you don't play everything. You start with what you want to play, mm-hmm. and then they go in and they...
They just call out what they want you to do.
Because I had two, and also finding out, this actually is bringing back so many terrible memories, because trying to find a piano, you know, I do stuff last minute. I've been working on that of late, but this was 2018, Katie. So literally, like, trying to find a pianist at jury time, everybody booked up. So I had to find two pianists. One to do Walton. I was still playing Walton. Ooh, jump scare. Oh, I remember this, because that second movement was questionable at best. I was so scared. I don't think... Who asked for that? Who asked for that second movement? God will deal with you.
Okay.
I don't remember what I played exactly, but I have excerpts on here.
Because
that's kind of like what was my focus.
Yeah, we used to do excerpts.
Makes sense.
I don't remember
what I didn't play excerpts until grad school.
I don't remember what the official... like, because we never went over the official jury requirements. It was just like he would just add stuff to my jury.
Wow, this brought back memories. Okay, mm-hmm. Katie. Anyway, I said that to say, when I was, if I got an MSM, I would have gone to MSM, but I also like applied to Yale, because I was like, Yale is free. So I could see a lot of people being like, well, Yale's actually, it's not, let me not spread misinformation. It's free, I'm pretty sure, but it's not like free. Like, you got to pay like for your books, and you got to pay for your whatever enrollment fee and stuff like that, you know? So I could see people being like, oh, Peabody free, I'm apply at Peabody. I can see that. If it's it Peabody will be free for me, therefore I'm going to apply.
Yeah. But it's also like I can see Peabody already being on your list. And I wonder how much it would move up. Like I remember when I was applying for schools, I really wanted to go to Eastman. And I felt like if I got into Eastman, I was going.
I was going. If I got into Eastman, I don't care what it costs. And see, that's where we are here today.
That's why I'm sitting over here right now.
You know how the shows be open up? Now, you might have wondered how I got here.
Because that's exactly a very bold. Problem. We knocking together our hard heads.
Right. A very bold and confident 22-year-old Katie said, baby girl, I don't care if Ohio State free.
And here go my my degree sitting right here. It's so much dust on it too. I mean, to be fair, what was I supposed to do with it? But
girl, I had to put mine under something because it started to crinkle up. Remember when you was over here? We use it for a TikTok. So that's how good my degree going for
me. To be fair, we use it for a reel too.
Do I even use my degree to this day? Oh, that's a lie. Of course I do. I play the viola still. I keep forgetting that. I play the viola and I teach. And I have my little thing that I would never say online. Wow. I mean, I don't regret it at all. I rarely. Yeah. I don't think I regret anything, actually.
No, nothing.
But, like, it's just like, Ohio State was free. So, I remember that. I was like, if I get an Eastman, I am going. And going, I did.
Yep.
It worked out. And
I went. So.
But
also, I wasn't faced with, well, if you go here, it's free. I was faced with going to a school in state that was significantly cheaper and that wanted me to go there. But I was like, if I get an Eastman, because I had my reach schools. Eastman was, for me, it was a reach school. I didn't think I was going to get in. So when I got in, I was like, I'm going. Like,
what I loved about Katie back then is that she just had such unwavering faith. It was just like, this is serendipitous. I was not planning on going to the school. Someone told me to apply. My teacher lit. It something just gave. My audition was, I'm not going to say what it was, but like what was said to me after the audition, but because just for the integrity of the process. But I had a feeling, I had my doubts because I got rejected from a similar school like a week before I found out about Eastman. And you know, I'm dramatic. I was like, oh, the humanity. I cried so much. I'm like, I can't believe I'm not going to Eastman. Girl, can you wait for the letter? Like, wait for the letter.
God looking at you like, okay.
Oh, my. He'd be so annoyed.
She let her
so
tuck her cell phone.
Literally. Like, but I had a feeling that I got in. And I haven't played that well since. Like, and obviously I've gotten better as a violist. Mm-hmm. But it's just like the confidence, everything was there. Literally every single thing. Nothing went wrong. Oh, one thing did go wrong, and that's Mr. Taylor's fault, low key. But he made me had a memory slip because I was doing something that he didn't like. So he like nodded like to keep going. And I was like, see, now I don't know what's next because I was doing my thing and you in my business. But it was fine. I was so sure I knew what I was doing. But I don't know. I feel like most of my schools, except the last one, it was kind of like, oh, not even, that's not even true. So most of my schools, it was like, I made the best choice for me. So like my first school, I was going to go to Concordia University because it was way cheaper. The viola teacher was enthusiastic, but something, I knew that Illinois State University would have better opportunities. It was slightly more expensive even then, because we're talking about state schools and a private school that gave me a good package. So and then Eastman, I was like, by hell or fire, Rochester seeing me. But I mean, we've strayed off course, but that's basically the gist of it. I mean, we were going to talk about like representation in music, but that's another conversation for another day. Because the idea is that now with these programs in place, like, or these opportunities rather in place, naturally more Black people will apply for these, but that's not the case, as we saw with NYU, because Black people oftentimes will self-select. They'll be like, I don't know. And I feel like this, I've heard the perfect analogy for this. I was in a webinar, and this screenwriter was talking about how he used to work at a script library, not the one that's today, but like something. And he used to do a log line. The bookstore rather would do a log line competition. And for those who don't know, a log line is like a one, some at most two sentence summary of a show or a movie. So like Abbott's would be something to the effect of like a young spunky teacher works together with her colleagues to make the best education experience for underfunded school in Philadelphia, something like that. And and so they would do this thing where like they would just put a log line out and people would submit their scripts. And what was interesting about it is that like they would get horror scripts back, comedy scripts, because it's just a log line, you could do whatever you want. So it's people like will come up with really creative things. And when they would do the stats of the scripts, they would see that like it's like overwhelmingly white men, overwhelmingly. And it's like very few women, very few women of color. And they were trying to figure like, why is this? And then he realized that, well, no tea, but it's just like accurate. Like you can see this in a lot of other areas as well. White men would just, they're throwing pasta at a wall. They just going, if it's not whatever, they're going to throw. And so often when I'm, when I'm writing something, I'm like, oh, is this funny? Is this good enough? Does this make any sense? Okay, I'll just apply to the next thing. And it's just like this unabashed confidence that like, and even if it's not even a confidence, it's kind of like, I'll just apply to the next thing. And it's like, for me, from where I'm sitting, like everything be like, make a break. I add stakes to everything. It's very exhausting. So I think that's, we'll see similar things. Like, I mean, I hope more Black people apply to Peabody, especially like with increased visibility of Black people in classical music. But even then, you don't know, because like, who y'all seeing in classical music, you know? Because if I think about like which classical musicians are in strings who are front facing, and it's like Melissa White and Sterling and Randall. But I feel like if you were to happen to see them on Instagram and you're like, I want to be a violinist too, someone who doesn't know anything about classical music, a parent who doesn't know anything about the field, would be like, you think you're finna be up there on that stage just like them? Like, you think it's easy just to go up there, not knowing that one, yes, they probably could be up on that stage. Thank you for, your child gets their confidence from you, and now we have to deal with them. Thanks. And two, there's so many things you could do with a degree in classical music, and not, those things are not always front facing. So lots of things to think about when it comes to that. Moving on.
Well, this week we are talking about an article that we came across in Van Magazine. It is linked in the description. And the article is called "The Price Is Wrong," which I was like, LOL. And it's basically,
that was kind of cute. Like, I know they were like, "Oh, I can't."
Right.
Like, I ate that one little thing.
And it's about some issues that have arisen in regards to Florence Price's music, the sheet music for some of her compositions. So it's written by Sharon Sue, which I've seen some of her posts about this subject like for a while now on Twitter. But she's a pianist who was talking about how she was trying to play some of Florence Price's music, but was noticing frequent mistakes and having to spend a significant amount of time correcting some of these mistakes. So she was going to write an article about it and really sort of investigate what is at the root of this. Am I the only person having these issues? and like what's going on. So in this article, she talks to other people, other musicians who corroborate what she's going, what she's running into when she's playing Florence Price's music, and just music by composers of color in general. In that a lot of the music is not accurate, and it just becomes more of a heavy lift for the performer to have to make corrections to it. So a couple years ago, G. Shermer, the publisher, acquired exclusive rights to Florence Price's music, many of her compositions. And that was sort of after this kind of resurgence of her music. Of course, they discovered those manuscripts of hers in 2009, but in 2020, they started playing a lot more Black composers and orchestras and across the board, really. Not just big orchestras, but in colleges and in youth orchestras, mid-sized orchestras, all of that. There's just been a more of a shift to trying to play composers of color and stuff like that. So in the midst of Florence Price's increased popularity, they acquired these rights to her music. But one of the other issues, in addition to the mistakes, was that they were hiking up the prices of renting her music. And in the article, one of the people who Sharon talks to is, she's a conductor at a college, and was saying how like playing one of Florence Price's symphonies was like wiping out 90% of her budget for the year for that ensemble, which is just freaking crazy.
Like, I don't just understand it like at all.
And then they also, in the article, it goes into the editing process and like how G. Shermer had chosen to turn around some of her music from manuscript to engraving very quickly, which of course contributed to these mistakes, but also like they weren't supporting engravers who had been engraving Florence Price's music with editing experience. And it's like anybody is going to need an editor when you're like mass producing music. So she spoke to one of the people who was like, I had all of these scores and stuff that I had done, but I needed support from them on that, and they just took what I had and put it out there without actually trying to make sure that it was accurate. So yeah, that piece of sort of having these mistakes in her music and in just music from composers of color, and also this aspect of like making it harder for people to even play the music is what we want to talk about. But when I was looking back, I was thinking of like, have I ever run into significant issues with mistakes in a piece and stuff like that? Like, misprints happen, but I've never had anything to this degree or anything that I felt was significant, at least to my recollection. But what about you?
Yeah, I'm trying to find where it, I feel like it was mentioned in the article, but like for some reason I can't find it. But even outside of that, like when I was reading it, obviously, like, let's not be dense. There's something that we must consider given the fact, rather, that Florence Price is Black, a Black woman at that, that there's so many mistakes. But I think about like dealing with pieces that have like pretty lengthy errata lists, like pretty famously Stravinsky, Rite of Spring, and Firebird. They all have lengthy errata lists. And my conducting teacher from undergrad, when I was in my conducting era, I remember that we was in master class one day. He spent like the entire 2 hours talking about these errata lists. I can't remember if he did like his master thesis on it or he did his PhD on it, but like there were so many mistakes in Stravinsky's music that like when you were to do one of these pieces, you would have to have an errata list so you knew what notes to play and what are the divisis and da da da. And I think the last time I played Rite of Spring, which was at Spoleto this past summer, we were not giving a list. So I think there had something had happened, because I remember going into it like, not only do I have to play this freaking piece again, I was also like, it's gonna be all this hoopla because this note is this note and this gotta be like this. And it wasn't. It was a clean copy. So maybe I'm remembering when I played Rite of Spring for the first time in 2013, maybe. So it could be like someone could comment and say like, oh no girl, way before then. But I'm pretty sure, because I remember it was this whole thing and Dr. Block was on the music librarian's ass because you got to do this, you got to. And I remember even when I briefly worked in the music library for the MSO, there was a piece, I forgot which one because there were so many of them, but like there's a piece that had Neurotilus with it. So it's very common for I think for pieces to, especially like ones that, you know, Stravinsky was like constantly editing Rite of Spring during his lifetime. So pieces like that from composers that we don't see very often or are starting to see more often, I feel like it's reasonable. What I don't think is reasonable is all of these mistakes and stuff like that. But even like on a smaller example outside of this errata list, I'm thinking about like conducting kids pieces, and like it's like, you know, a lot of the times in kids music, you know, the second violin and viola are playing the same thing, and the viola got a C sharp and the violin got a D, and it's like mistakes happen, you know. And you know, sometimes I'll be like, why y'all da-da-da? And I feel like happened over the summer. I'm like, play the note. What you, hello? And it's like, oh, my bad. I apologize to children. I'll be like, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Because there's a mistake in the part, you know? So that's fine. I feel like it's bound to happen. But it's like to this degree, and especially with your big puffed up chest talking about like, I own all the rights to it, then do like, then act right, you know? But, right.
And also, like, when you talked about y'all spent that whole conducting rehearsal 2 hours talking about all these mistakes, like, that was another thing that stuck out to me about the article, was, like, y'all are essentially acting, I mean, essentially acting as gatekeepers to her music because y'all have all the rights to it, but are not putting in the effort to actually make it playable. And with everything that has to do with, you know, playing music, like all this stuff costs money, not just the music itself costs money. Y'all are hiking the prices up on that too, but like time is money. So mm-hmm. Now you have people who are like, in like, for example, there was one in the article, people who had to take it off their program because they got the music and there were so many mistakes. They were like, the time that it would take us to go through these scores and correct all these mistakes, the concert has come and gone. Like, yeah, we need something that we can put play. That,
and it's some orchestra librarian that the musicians are not doing that. It's the orchestra librarians and any assistants they have, if they have, that are going to be going through and doing every single part. And even, like, that's actually, like, ridiculous.
And sometimes, and that's the thing, is like, sometimes, especially when you have people who have smaller budgets or they don't have an orchestra librarian, then they do have to do that. And so now you have like people who are, they just don't have the money to pay somebody for their time, mm-hmm. to do something like that. Or like in her case, in Sharon's case, being a pianist, just doing it yourself, comparing to other people. And some of the people that she talked to was like, yeah, girl, it's just like, it's par for the course over here. That's just like mm-hmm. what it's been.
And a great person that I have talked to us about this would be Artina, because I played she went to SUNY, is that Geneseo, in 2018, maybe. It could be, no, it had to, because I knew Armin by then, so it had to be 2018 2019 she went to SUNY Geneseo and played the Florence Platt's Piano Concerto, and then fast forward played it with MSO in 2023. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I wonder how different were those performances, not in experience, but just like in notes on the page. And like, especially since she's been playing that concerto for so long. And Samantha Ije, which did you meet her? No, that was Clint and her mom. Mm-hmm. Do you know her? Yeah. Samantha Ije is one of the scholars on Price's work as well. And I'm wondering like how different those are, because if this was 2019, you know, yeah, if this was 2019, a lot happened between 2019, especially like in the world with Black Lives Matter, Shermer buying the rights to her stuff. how did the notes change? But it seemed like not very much. I using a typewriter and a PDF file, and they just gluing them together and selling it for $1,000 a copy. So,
right. Some of these pianists probably have their own, like, they just got mm-hmm. their own copy that they'd be marking up. And then when they go to play with different orchestras, they just got to reconcile that copy with whatever the orchestra mm-hmm. has rented. Mm-hmm. But also, like, the fact that, I mean, talking about price, price as okay. the amount. No, because I realized that.
The author did, like, one of them, no pun intended, please, I'm begging you, let it rest.
No, like, I really was like, oh, wait, I forgot we actually talking about Florence Price. But talking about the price of just the scores, like, how y'all hiking up the prices, we was talking about how, like, G. Shermer, the price of their scores is not always, like, super high. Like, they're known for having, like, cheaper scores. Like, even in the mm-hmm. article, they compare them to another publisher, the same piece. I think it's a Beethoven sonata. Yeah, the 32 Beethoven piano sonatas. Dang, he was right. 32 Beethoven piano sonatas from Henley Verlag will set you back $151.90. Shermer sells them for $39.99. I don't know.
So it's more than double the price, you say?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be one of them people because the devil doesn't need an advocate. But now hearing that, because Nikki loves saying, I'm like, girl, the devil don't need an advocate. It's right. Because it's annoying. Because she's one of those people that's like, yeah, girl, no. But now that I hear that back, it's frustrating, I understand. I'm just trying to say that, like, Florence Price is a newer... I feel like you always pay more for newer music. You know what I'm saying? Like, she's in a different time period. I want to know how much Stravinsky... What were her dates? Yeah, like, how much is a Debussy score? Wait, hold on.
Did I play something? Let's figure out right now. I'm about to see.
Yeah, because that will give me more, like... And also someone who's like, or like Ligeti. How much is a Ligeti score?
So you're saying you want to check somebody who's around her days. What about somebody even newer?
Or even newer, yeah. Even newer,
okay, because I see John Corleone.
Yeah, like this one, this piano concerto by Ligeti is $52. Because I remember reading that. I was like, I don't know if that's a, like, I'm all for, like, let's stand up for Black women. This is, like, obviously it's trash, but also that's not accurate to me. Like, that wasn't a good comparison for me. Like, of course, Beethoven's music is going to be cheaper. It's been around longer. It's more, he's like a more widely renowned composer. He has a lot of music. A lot of people own rights to it. It's in the public domain, on and on and on and on and on. Yeah, it's going to be cheaper versus, like, this Ligeti sonata. It's a concerto for violin and piano is $53.
That comparison was between two Beethoven sonatas. How much would somebody else charge?
I see. Oh, okay.
Yeah, because I don't know how much they're charging for Florence Price, like, scores in comparison to that. It was just saying that, like, Shermer is known for being sort of a...
Oh, it's like they're just cheaper.
Yeah.
But I also think, like, yeah, I think I see what that is, like, so between two Beethoven. But I think, like, my idea for why, like, when we think about, like, market value, I'm not saying charge more. I'm not saying I think they still need to answer for, like, what was going on, especially, like, if you're gonna charge more, then at least make it right. But I will say that, like, at the end of, like, I don't know. What I'm trying to say is that while it's not right, I could see how, like, they gonna charge, they gonna price it, like, you know, a little, like, in the same way that they will price any other composer in her, what's that word, any of her contemporaries. What's ironic about this, Sherman probably got lots of money, but, like, I'm trying to figure out why they was the ones to be like, yeah, me, when there's, like, more reputable publishing houses that could have taken this on. Mm-hmm. Shermer, they're not American.
I don't think so.
They probably got an American location.
Oh, no, they're American.
They are?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so maybe it was like...
Let's see.
Maybe it was like, this is...
Yeah.
That's probably why they took it on versus like Henley or Baron Ryder. But I remember like when I was buying music more regularly, I would be told not to buy no Shermer edition or nothing. Depending on what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like you could buy you some, you know, little LaKreutzer etudes or whatever, but like if you're gonna buy a Brahms Sonata, you're gonna buy the Burlap. The Henley Verlag or Baron, I don't think Baron Ryder does the Brahms Sonata. Maybe they do. I don't know. But I was told not to buy no Shermer edition and no what's them etudes, the hard ones. Like I just remember being told that pretty often. So because they be, but now that I know that they're American, I'm also wondering what that's about. But I'm not gonna go down that rabbit hole because that whole like. Elitism thing, like you want me to buy it directly from Germany, like mm-hmm. I don't know, but I heard that across several teachers.
One of the things that they mentioned in the article is like when they put out this press release saying, oh, we have the rights to her music, we're going to be doing all the editing ourselves and stuff like that, that's the part that's missing. Where's the editing? And I don't know. I feel like there used to be, or according to this, there used to be a little bit, I guess I would say like more of a path to accessibility for her music. Like there used to be that people could go to. So if you're going to sort of cut off that path, but girl, I'll be on IMSOP, so.
Yeah, I thought her stuff wasn't her stuff on IMSOP for a minute, and then they bought the rights.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I remember that. Come back into the public domain, not back.
Like, was that a fever dream? I know Adoration up there and a couple other things because I remember with my kids last summer, I was like, "We playing." Well, I'm like, "We playing a black composer because I can't do all this rah rah rah,
mm-hmm.
and get up there and just play Shoe Symphony and we call it a day." And it was hard too because like that's another thing, like that's why I was talking to Amari about this. If you're a black composer, you need to, like, I'm not telling you what to do, like I'm not telling you what to do with your inspiration and what the Lord or, you know, the universe be speaking to you, but you need to be writing more kids music. It's not no kids music or not a lot of kids music for written by black composers. So I had my kids, you know, doing their best through Adoration. And it was a little hard for them, and they were not thrilled. And I was like, well, listen, one thing about me, we either going to play Florence Price or we going to only play Florence Price. So I'm going to need you to fix the attitude when the black lady comes out, or this is the only thing that we will be playing. And we could put all the other pieces, and we could just work on this one. But, yeah, write more pieces for children so we can program black composers.
Now what I want to know is that, like, since you have people say, oh, don't buy that Shermer, like, if there's anybody who has also had the same experience or who has Shermer music and knows, like, is this just them, you know, like, is it not actually unique to Florence Price? I mean, the fact that she talked to other people in the article that said, like, they've played music by Florence Price and other composers of color, but specifically by Florence Price, that has had mistakes in it from Shermer, does show that there is probably a higher percentage of mistakes in her music, especially since a lot of people do use Shermer editions of things. So I'm guessing that these are people who maybe have used this music, used Shermer editions in the past, have been fine, and then bought Florence Price's music. And it also is backed up by the fact that they turned it around so quickly. Mm-hmm. And then she talked to one of those engravers. But also, if it's simply like a cheaper brand of music, like that's just kind of crazy to me. Because it's like, you know how on Uber, you could, like, walk more and save money? Like,
I remember that. They brought it back. I was surprised they brought it back. They called it something else, but I remember Uber Pool.
Well, Uber Pool is like when you carpool, but they used to have the thing. They had another thing where if you would
get picked up
or dropped off further away from your destination. So that's basically this. They like, well, if you compose a little bit of it yourself, then we knock a couple dollars off. But that's the thing. Are y'all knocking a couple dollars off?
That's the thing.
Because it seemed like y'all knocked a couple on because y'all saw that people was playing her music a lot more.
And I know, like, this is on our list, but, like, they haven't commented on it. I feel like it would be in their best interest to comment on it because if I wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt, it seems like they are charging based on, like, what they would charge for their contemporary, for her contemporaries. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I can't speak to her, like, rental music because I don't really remember a lot about how rentals work and I don't remember how much they cost. But when I look at, like, how much Illuminati Sonata costs, like, how much, you know, it's, I didn't look up any of the composers, but it's like, okay, well, it's significantly more expensive than buying, like, Stamitz Viola Concerto that he wrote it in freaking 1850. So I'm also, I feel like it would be in their best interest to be like, I mean, I probably won't believe them, but still just to clear the air and be like, y'all, it's market price for a composer of her dates.
Well, this says that their price piano concerto rental fee is over $2,000 for the conductor score and orchestra parts, which is five times as much as Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on the Theme of Paganini, which was written the same year.
Oh, there's the answer. You know what I could give them? Because I'm really not trying, because you know, y'all know me. Y'all don't know me, but like, I'm not ever going to willingly, hold on, let me rephrase that. I'm not going to go out of my way to defend the clear aggressor. Like, but I'm just trying to get an understanding of it. Because Florence Price is new to the scene, as in very new, as in what was it when they found it in that 2012? It's like, Rock been mining off, you know what I'm saying? Like, we've been playing his stuff this whole time. It's more work to prepare the Florence Price scores. However, where they lost me, I could have, if it really, you know what? She ate this up because I could really be on your side if it was prepared well.
Right.
If you were like, oh, you know, you gotta, you know, to put up two bands to play Florence Price because, you know, it really extends our engravers and we don't got a certain amount of people on here and we gotta do all this work because we don't know, da da da. And it was like 90% correct. But you got the girls having to whip out Sibelius in the rehearsal, you know, like, okay, I'm back. I try, y'all. I try to be
we
like...
We both back because my brain was... It was giving smooth.
Like, I was really trying and then I got lost in the buying with the beta, but I'm back. No, because the rock mic... She covered her tracks because it really was giving like, oh, Beethoven's cheaper. Well, yes.
Well, another thing that was brought up and I thought was relevant was... The fact that, first of all, these significant misprints, one of them, I think it was one of the piano quintets or something like that, had what they called 150 significant misprints. 150 is insane. Like, that's crazy to me. But
like, what does significant mean? Because I remember we just played a new piece, a new oratorio, written by a black woman. I was like, period. But some of the movements, you know how you have, what's that called, a pickup measure, because I know how to read music. Some of the parts labeled the pickup measure as measure one. So Kyle saying start at measure 30, we start at measure 31. Mm-hmm. That's a huge time waster in rehearsal, you know what I mean? That to me is a significant error. Is it that, or is it like, I would think so, because it wastes time. You have to figure out why people not starting the right measure. okay, let's start at A. Let's just start at A. A's in the wrong spot. That's a significant error. I'm thinking about stuff. I mean, that's me thinking about, like, you have a clock on stage that you need to, and now we're taking, you know, a half a minute to realize, oh, your part is mismarked. It's like having different additions on stage. A significant error to me is also, like, this is supposed to be a major chord, but somebody playing B flat.
Yeah, that's a significant error to me. To me, I wouldn't classify the measure thing as a significant error. Although it, like, it's still, I could see why you would say that, because from a performer's perspective, like, that's going to derail what we have going on. I feel like a significant error is something that changes the piece, like, changes the way it sounds. Mm. And I would say, like, something that, like, yeah, a wrong note, something that changes the chord, something like that. So something that changes the way it sounds, with the exception of, like, dynamics and stuff like that, I probably wouldn't say, like, oh, there was supposed to be a crescendo here. I would say dynamics
were significant. I think so.
I think to an extent, it depends. It depends.
Like, I would say dynamics are significant. Length of notes, something's supposed to be an eighth note. Missing articulations, mm-hmm. especially for newer pieces. Because, like, so if articulations are missing from, like, Stamets, it's like, you can infer based on the time period what it would be. Yeah. Those are all significant to me.
For me, dynamics depends on the context. I do think that, like, to count, I guess I'm thinking of more like a hierarchy. I think, like, notes are at the top, notes and length of notes, like, pitches and length of notes are at the top. Like, this, you recomposed it. That's not what this is. And then dynamics under that, depending on the context of it. Like, oh, like, I would say something like this. Like, if a dynamic is missing or wrong, I would say that that's, I mean, technically both are wrong. But, like, complete, like, oh, it's supposed to be forte in this piano. Like, significant. If it's completely missing, significant. If there's something like, sometimes, say it's supposed to be a crescendo over four bars and it's over three bars, I still think that's a significant, but it's not as significant as all the ones that I put above them.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've been thinking about, like, since it just said significant errors, mm-hmm. they all, like, the same to me in that they're all significant. Because I'm thinking about, like, how a dynamic can completely change the way you play something. Like, mm-hmm. thinking about how I'm sitting in the chair, I'm in orchestra, like, how would I play this from that detailed perspective. But there should be no errors in there. Or, like, that's not really fair, but, like, definitely not significant errors, and definitely not plenty of them. And so what is it really giving? It really gave that y'all got it from her Little Rock, and y'all just scanned them and send them off. Like, I don't understand that. How does that happen? You not check them? What's the process for, you know, publishing music? I want to talk to somebody, because to what extent do they go through and they edit it? You know, if a composer got their stuff and they wrote their stuff, are you supposed to, especially like the lady, what's her name? The lady is crazy for the article I'm talking about. I want to say your name, baby.
Who's Sharon?
Mm-hmm.
Who wrote the, yeah.
Sharon had mentioned that, you know, there's a practice in classical music of really honoring what's on the page. So I want to know, from composer hand to editor, to what degree is that honor? Because I'm also wondering, like, is it just like, oh, this is what she wrote, so therefore we gonna put it? And if you don't know what she wrote, is there somebody on staff who might know? Like, y'all have musicologists, y'all have, you know, composer people, like, arrangers. You know, that's what I'm curious about. What's the process? Because I bet you wish if Carlos Simon brought his piece to them, they're not going to be like, well, I think in measure four, this should be this, and the crescendo should be here instead of here. Like, I'm sure it's not that. I'm sure they take what's on the ink, they assume that it's correct, and they will publish it. But that's me guessing.
Yeah, I think the whole thing about what's on the page is also like, y'all are at this point misrepresenting her music to an audience. Yeah. There might be somebody that, okay, now they hear this variation on a theme by Florence Price, is basically what some of this is, if you talk about 150 significant errors. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like that's like a disservice to her, because like, she wrote what she wrote, and now you're altering whatever that is, and it's being shared with an audience without any, especially when you could properly edit it, get Price experts to come in if there's any ambiguity around what was in the manuscript, like that is an option.
Yeah, and also there's a level of disrespect I find right there, because I don't know what the protocol is for that, but like, do you assume that there aren't people who are experts on her music? Did you care to research that? What's the turnaround for that? Like, did you not have, it's not in the budget to ask them? Like, I feel like we just live in an information era for decades now, actually. So I really feel like there's no excuse for that outside of things about publishing that I don't understand from being an outsider.
Well, yeah, because they talked to some Price experts for this article. So they also got a bit of a comment from Shermer just on the acquisition of Florence Price's music. They did not comment on their editing process or any of the concerns that she had, you know, about that. They chose not to comment on that. So it's unclear of like the steps they're taking to move forward, what they're going to do about it. Do they even see it as a concern? And what they feel like their responsibility is, because not 100% of her music is under their rights deal, but a significant amount of it is. So we'll also be able to see that once other publishers start entering the equation with whatever pieces are not under their deal. We'll be able to see, I guess, more clearly any differences there are in pricing her music. So,
well, y'all better say something quick. Fix it immediately.
It's giving statements, giving some of the stuff like at least making it more affordable. People gonna have to put in that amount of work themselves in the mean, like while you guys are also putting in the work to have it properly edited. Because not y'all being like, well,
right.
I don't know.
Who publishes old dude's music? The British one.
Samuel Coleshiller.
Yeah. Let me see. Because
I guess somebody has. Yeah, he's public domain. So anybody, I guess.
Who is this white man? Oh, there was also a poet name. I was like, oh no. There's a poet named Samuel Coleridge Taylor. Period. But guess what? Guess who pops up first when you Google him? Amen. And Ashe. Oh, he was kind of slick with it. Come on, hat. All right. Oh, he died from pneumonia. That's tragic. Wow. All right. Moving on. All right, y'all, time for Black Excellence, where we hype you up, gas you up, and give you your props, because there's room for everyone at the top. Who are you talking about, Delaney?
This week, I am talking about Dr. Brandon Wattles. He is a composer and an educator who has worked as a transcriber for Black gospel music, for numerous choral octavos and hymnals and hymnal supplements. He also has shared his scholarship on Black sacred music. I'm at Harvard and Yale, Morehouse, Hampton, and most recently on PBS on American Black Journal. He recently served as music director for the Grammy Award-winning artist Ledisi, And he's a national music director for NAACP's Act So competition, in addition to his memberships with the National Association for Negro Musicians and the American Choral Directors Association. So, shout out to Dr. Brandon Wattles, period.
Period. My piece of the week is Adoration. It's on IMSLP. Win girlies, look it up. Transcribe it and do it correctly, quickly. Thank you so much for listening to Classically Black Podcast. Don't forget to follow us on social media at Classically Black Podcast. If you have a piece of the week suggestion, a Black excellence suggestion, or an intermission suggestion, send us to classicallyblackpodcast@gmail.com. We got merch, y'all. That's classicallyblackpodcast.com/store. If you're Black, join ISBM. That's Eyes Black Musicians on social media, eyesblackmusicians.com. Join the Ebony Tower. That's patreon.com/classicallyblackpodcast. We got all type of stuff forthcoming, y'all. Just we doing the best we can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you in the next one. That's not the outro for this particular. See you next week is what I normally say.
Bye, y'all.